This is a CKTZ news update. I'm Lonnie Taylor. Cortez Island is one of the islands that makes up the Discovery Islands and is surrounded by Desolation Sound and the Salish Sea. This has been habitat for several types of whales, including humpbacks and orcas. I caught up with Misty McDuffie. Misty is the Wild Salmon Program Director for Raincoast Conservation Foundation. McDuffie has an update for Cortez Island on the status of orcas as well as their food supply. So, Misty McDuffie, tell me what you do as a marine biologist in this region.
Most of my focus is on salmon. And it was never a direct route to studying salmon, because when I first started off, I was very enamored with many of the other creatures that had bigger fins and feathers and fur. And it was really working in the watersheds on the BC coast and through the Great Bear Rainforest that I developed this awareness of what a profound influence salmon really have on our coastal ecosystems. And that has really led into the work that I do now, which is as primarily on fisheries and trying to make fisheries so that they are sustainable and that they consider different ecosystems in their management. And that goal still eludes us here in British Columbia. It's still all about the humans. As in most parts of the world, fisheries are really managing their sort of sustainability from an economic perspective, in their ability to meet the needs of humans and other predators that also depend on these fish, and the ecosystems often get left out of the equation. So much of my time is spent on the predators and the ecosystems that also require salmon.
You are the Wild Salmon Program Director for Raincoast Conservation Foundation.
I am. When we say wild, we don't just mean wild as opposed to farmed fish. We also mean wild as opposed to fish coming from hatchery. So it's all about allowing natural populations, wild fish, to go back to their rivers and to spawn, choosing their own mates. Like, that doesn't happen in a hatchery. Choosing their own mates and spawning in wild rivers. And that those eggs are laid in the gravel, and the development of those eggs happens in a wild river, and they're cued to the signature and the conditions of that river, and over generations through parents and offspring are coming back more or less to that same location. And those wild fish can be distributed through a watershed from the very top of the headwaters down to the intertidal areas that meet the ocean. And it's that piece about their influence across the whole watershed that helps us put that importance on wild fish as opposed to hatchery fish.
In layman's terms for the listeners, what is it that you do?
So I look at a lot at fishing plans, annual fishing plans. I look at where those fisheries are conducted. I look at how many fish get to spawn, how many make it through the hooks and the nets and actually get back to the rivers. And then I also look at how much does the wildlife need, whether that's grizzly bears or killer whales. Are we leaving enough salmon so that the wildlife that depend on them get enough to eat? And that really comes down to how many fish get caught and how many get to spawn. It can come down to some very simple concepts, even though a lot of the times it can be these really complex situations of the time and the area of fisheries and how many fish are there and do they know how many fish are there and how many are they going to let get through and how, do they even know how many they're letting through? But at its simplest level, it's really about how much you take and how much you leave.
So the information and research that you're collecting, what does Raincoast Conservation Foundation do with that information?
It depends, can be diverse in the areas that we work, but we try to use that information to inform better decision making. That's really what we're all about. We're advocates, but we say we're informed advocates because we are conducting research and trying to apply it so that humans can make better decisions about how we manage ecosystems and wildlife. And I would always go back, as soon as I say those words, I would go back and say, actually, ecosystems and the wildlife don't need any managing. It's the humans that need the managing. So in collecting this information, that it'll inform our ability to make better decisions.
And are politicians and policymakers consulting the rain coast?
It depends. Often we want their attention more. So sometimes they do come to us, especially when issues get a lot of profile and governments or decision makers are unsure how to go on certain things, or they want to better understand the science of a situation. And across the board at Raincoast, we've got some pretty phenomenal experts on our team. And sometimes government comes to us and says, how do we better understand this? How do we conduct a study to better understand this? Or what kind of information should we be considering in making decisions? So it goes both ways. Sometimes we're knocking at their door and saying, hey, you're not paying any attention to this, and this could help us all live with a lighter footprint. And other times they seek us out.
So you spoke about the predators that you focus on, salmon predators. We here on Cortez Island are very blessed in that we see quite a lot of salmon predator activity. So I'm really interested to hear what the health status is of whales in the region, just because there's people say things like their populations are snapping back and this or that. So I'm just really curious what's actually going on from a marine biologist's perspective.
The type of whales that consume the most salmon are our resident killer whales. And so we've got three different, what we call ecotypes of killer whales in coastal BC, that we've got the salmon eaters that are called the residents. We've got the marine mammal eaters that are called the bigs or the transient killer whales. And then we've got another group of killer whales that's more offshore. And we don't know as much about them, but the scientists that study them think they largely eat sharks. So three different ecotypes. One ecotype eats salmon. And then in BC, there's two broad populations of those resident killer whales. There's the northern residents and the southern residents. The northern residents are doing not too badly. Their populations are growing. Their numbers are up. They've got more pods within their population, and they're doing much better. The southern residents, on the other hand, are critically endangered, and their numbers are only declining since they were listed about 20 years ago now. And in southern British Columbia, we have very congested waters with vessel traffic. We have the fish populations down here. The salmon populations tend to not be as robust as the ones that are being accessed by the northern residents, also because they're migrating. Northern residents have access to them before the southern residents. And the waters down here are contaminated. So these three things, not enough food, too noisy of a living environment that prevents the whales from successfully catching their prey, and the contamination within that prey, have all conspired to meet a declining population that is critically endangered. It's very interesting. And that border between those two populations, what sort of divides the Salish Sea from the central and north coast, is right around Cortez Island, right where you are, that dividing line. You probably even see it, like the southern parts of Cortez swing with the Salish Sea, right? Like the weather is influenced by the Salish Sea, and Salish Sea is having a good day, a beautiful day. So is the southern part of Cortez, but the northern part probably swings more with Johnson Strait and the north. So the range of the southern residents is as far as Cortez. And then on the other side of your island, you're getting the tail end of the range of the northern residents. Those are the salmon eaters, and two very different states of populations based on vessel traffic, the amount of salmon they have access to, and the contaminants that are in those salmon.
Wow, that's all very interesting. How you describe the salmon is coming from the north and the northern region is getting access to that first, as if there's nothing coming from the south.
So I'm talking about their migration routes, but in terms of the health of salmon populations as well. So if we look at the range of this population right on the border, because they're at what we call a transboundary population. So they're shared whales. The U.S. has responsibility for them as well, and they're listed as endangered in the U.S. as well. So if you look at the range of all the resident killer whales, it overlaps on North America with the range of Chinook salmon. And the further south you go, the worse it seems that Chinook salmon are doing. That's a generalization, but the southern end of their range is in more dire straits than in the north. When these salmon go to sea, they leave their watersheds from San Francisco all the way up to Alaska. So the tiny little fish leave their watersheds and they migrate north to the Gulf of Alaska. And they spend time in the North Pacific, generally around the Gulf of Alaska. And then they migrate back home and they do that along the shelf. So they migrate north along the shelf when they're tiny little fish as juveniles. And when they come back, they migrate south down the shelf as adults. So that's how they move and they intertwine with the North Pacific and why on their migration route south, the northern residents have access to them before the southern residents.
To connect this to back to humans, what you were saying right in the beginning, it's about managing humans and not nature. What is it that humans need to do? How do they need to be managed in order to allow nature to replenish and heal and recuperate these populations of orca whales?
Yeah, and the salmon as well, right? It's our footprint across ecosystems, across different species. It's all intertwined. If we start with saying the most basic thing that these whales need is adequate food supply, then how do we manage salmon differently? We probably don't have time to get into the hatchery discussion, so I'm going to leave that aside for right now, and I'm going to focus on what we're doing to their habitat. What humans tend to do, if you think of salmon being reliant on watersheds where they spawn, and these rivers that they make their way to have tributaries, and water flows through the rivers and the tributaries. The more that we conduct activity in those drainages where the rivers are, the more we change the flow of water, the quality of water, the amount of water. So we get floods and droughts. The more that we pave, the more that we sprawl, the more we clear cut, the more mining activities, or at least open pit mining activities, all of these things all affect how water moves through a watershed, which affects the salmon that try to spawn in that watershed and the survival of those salmon. So if we can't give these salmon healthy rivers with clean water that isn't a drought in the summer and isn't a flood in the winter, that's what we've got to get to. So it really means changing the way that we live and on the landscape. And that's in the watershed. But there's no policies that say, oh, we have to think about salmon when we're putting in a housing development, or we have to think about salmon when we're building roads or putting in ditches or putting up a mall. There's no connection between, oh, what you're doing on the landscape is affecting the ability of these fish to survive. That is a total disconnect. So what we often are advocating for is what we call fish first policy. So when you make a decision, a land use decision in a watershed that has salmon and coastal British Columbia, that's most of them, that you've got to think about how your that footprint of what you're doing is going to affect the survival and the habitat of salmon. So that's a really big one, and one where there's the greatest disconnect. And in some cases, we've got a really intransigent province here in British Columbia that we know that for years we've known about the impacts of clear-cut logging on the health of salmon populations. We know what happens when we pave these watersheds and change hydrology. We know the implications of all of the footprint that we have, but we just continue to do it. So there's a really still a big schism between how we're living on the landscape and what salmon need to survive in harmony with us. And there's a lot of ways we could be making different decisions about how we live on the landscape. And often all comes back to the bigger picture of growth in our economy. And we're wed to this economic model of extraction of commodities, volume-based. And in this day and age, we're really starting to understand that we can't keep growing on a finite planet, but that's what we're trying to continue to do. And so we just have to look at salmon to say, there's a fundamental shift that has to occur in how we're showing up on the planet, both in terms of our economic models and our consumption and our choices, and then right down to the choices that we're making just living within a watershed on a daily and weekly basis. So we can link salmon to many things.
Lonnie Taylor, CKTZ News, Cortez Island. CKTZ News is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, the program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.